And on the flip side of it, I mean, now it seems like the people who are aware of simulations have become very hypercritical, if that's a word, or super cynical, and they don't believe anything about those numbers at all. And it's like, where do you find that middle ground?
And then what do you trust anymore?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Then you'll just trust what you want because you think everything is lying to you.
Yeah. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the third episode of Stuff We Don't Learn in School's podcast. My name is Jenny.
And I'm Victoria.
And today we will be talking about modeling simulations. Oh my gosh, how fun and exciting. No, it actually is very fun and exciting. Like, inherently, you think of that topic and you're like, oh.
Ah, you guys chose that one, huh?
Like, it's not nearly as, you know, in depth or, well, no, it is, but on surface level, you think of modeling simulations and you don't think about the complexities of it like you do with, say, education or, you know, political ideologies.
And it's hard to see where it relates to you. I know, like, education, I think of my schooling, or like political ideologies, I think of how my parents and I have different beliefs. For this, I'm like, oh no.
Like the Matrix?
Yeah. Like, numbers?
Like, huh? Yeah, a lot of people think of, like, you know, coding and creating, you know. Okay, so whenever COVID started, there was this simulation that was going around.
Oh, the Johns Hopkins, right?
Yeah. But yeah, that's the only thing that really comes to my mind or came to my mind before we started doing research on this topic.
Yeah, no, me too. And also the one thing I did think of was just whenever you're on that YouTube rabbit hole and you just keep watching, I've watched Elon Musk say we're in a simulation.
Yeah, dude, it's kind of crazy because so many, like, well-versed, super smart, very famous, extremely, you know, wealthy people believe that we live in a simulation. But there's so much more to simulations and statistics and data because so much of our legislation and so many extremely impactful global decisions are made off of data and simulations that predict the future so that we can reroute the future away from, like, a potential disaster or from graphs and statistics. But yeah, they're so impactful in that regard. And so that, for me at least, begs the question, is it bad to put all of our trust into this data? Because I know so many people who have told me, and I was and am one of those people who is like, the only thing that I can trust nowadays is science and is data. So what happens whenever we don't understand the limits of data and science?
I think that's one of the largest questions probably of our time, just given how connected we are and how important, again, these numbers can be. Like you mentioned, a lot of our safety precautions were based on specific models for COVID, and different models, again, had different limitations because whenever you create a simulation, either you're using past data most of the time from other countries in COVID's case and just seeing, like, for example, China and Italy, how their trend line was going and base it on that for the US. And obviously, a lot of the times there are a lot of discrepancies because we're different. We have varying economies, varying populations, cultures. So it doesn't always work out. Yeah. Or this is a giant oversimplification, but you either use past data or you create parameters. But like Jenny said, what parameters do you create? Like, how do you measure the effect of taking precautions? Like, how do you assign a number or value to that? And I think the problem with all of this is, like, I don't even know if it's science, because I think the science community within themselves is very well versed and they know what's happening. Mm-hmm. I think it's like,
it's more of a public education issue.
Yeah. It's like, what do we make of all of this?
Yeah, exactly. Because again, people trust data. People trust statistics. People trust what they perceive to be, like, logistically figured out and everything is concrete.
Yeah, quantitative.
Exactly. And not many people understand that statistics and data and simulations and all of these different things that seem to be so concrete aren't.
Yeah, and the problem is, like, once you don't understand, for example, again, like, what a specific model's limitations are, then different policymakers can use those models to forward another agenda. And basically what can happen is people will misuse it to get what they want because mm-hmm. numbers and data and what we make sense of the world through quantitative measurements are just held to such a standard and such a level. Yeah, like one thing I wanted to talk to you about is I think on one end, there are a lot of people who follow numbers and that's the way to persuade them. It's kind of like the rhetorical triangle we learned in English where it's like, pathos, ethos, logos. And some people are very strongly centered around like logos. But on the flip side, I mean, there
are people. Which is logic, by the way.
Oh, yeah, logic.
For those of you who don't know what logos is.
And on the flip side of it, I mean, now it seems like the people who are aware of simulations have become very hypercritical, if that's a word, or super cynical, and they don't believe anything about those numbers at all. And it's like, where do you find that middle ground?
And then what do you trust anymore?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Then you'll just trust what you want because you think everything is lying to you.
Yeah.
And it's like such a...
That it's such like a mind-boggling, it's a seesaw. You have to balance it. You have to know like what to trust and what to look for in a simulation or a graph and understand the limitations of that specific simulation or graph and what simulations or graphs simply are fake all the way through or just mm-hmm. like are untrustworthy, period.
Yeah, I think there was a COVID model simulation that basically came to the result of if you're biking or running, I believe. I think it was published on Medium. I read it a while ago. You have to be 25 feet away from each other instead of 6. And that drew up a lot of controversy because, I mean, if, you know, the simulation says 25, I mean, Jenny, like, bye, like, yeah, like, yeah, like, see, like, goodbye. I'm not going to like come near you.
Yeah.
But I think what happened was something within it was misleading and the like simulation held different parameters than what people thought it was. So then it came to a different conclusion than what other simulations did. But again, I mean, if that's posted online, why would you want to question it? Because, I mean, it's so much more work on your end uh-huh. to want to look into the model with code and the description when it's not
it's
such
not
a fun
exactly
thing to do.
User-friendly.
Yeah, exactly.
For the public, which is such a big issue because there are so many examples within history where logic and like published studies have misled a whole cohort of people. For example, Andrew Wakefield's study, for those of you who don't know, his study was published and it eventually propelled the anti-vax movement. So the conclusion that he drew up from his study was that the, I believe it was the MMR vaccine caused autism. And that's, you know, one of the major arguments that you hear from anti-vaxxers is that vaccines cause autism. He only used 12 children in his study.
When Jenny told me, I was like, dang, you couldn't go over 15? Like, not a 5 or a 0. It had to be 12. Like,
12 kids. Oh, my gosh. The fact that so many people followed him just because, you know, it's a study. It's a published study. So obviously, since it's published, that means that it must be true. It, like, science has to support it. And then, like, because they only see his conclusion and they don't look into how he created this study and they don't understand, like, biases and how biases can affect experimentation, then it created this whole movement that in the end essentially harms public health mm-hmm. to such a great extent.
Mm-hmm. And I think the larger problem is we don't understand how complex these systems within the scientific field are because we aren't really taught them. I'm not gonna lie, like in my years in science, and I've been lucky to have, oh my gosh, I've been able to take AP bio, AP physics, yes, and be able to encounter great teachers and difficult content. Mm-hmm. But even then, I don't feel like I really understand the scientific method because what are we taught? We're taught like, okay, ask a question.
Hypothesize.
Exactly.
Observe. Analyze.
I think
observes
first, but yeah.
Oh, wait. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, and even then, like, what even are the steps? Who knows? Like, I don't know. Do you know? Like, it's... Yeah. And the labs we do, I know in physics, we just did this river lab, and it's not to throw any teacher or anyone under the bus. But first, it's tough because of COVID. But second, given the nature of lab and the way school is set, you can't really go in depth into an experiment. And the way I see experiments, if I hadn't done things like science fair or have parents within the field, I would have thought it was just like this kind of very simple 2-day long thing where you run. But the system, which in like theories get proved and also like findings become relevant to the public, there's so much peer review that happens and people need to replicate it.
Yeah. And in experimentation in school, like obviously it's good that we do experimentation in school, because if we didn't, then we'd be,
that'd be boring.
That'd be boring. And two, like, we really would not have learned anything. Like, experimentation is the basis of science. Mm-hmm, you know?
Exactly.
So it's great that we do them, but, you know, a part that you can't really replicate in school that really does need to be noted is biases within experimentation, which was one of the issues with Andrew Wakefield's experiment. Because he did have biases towards the data in his conclusion.
Yeah.
So, you know, the way that he chose those kids was like oddly specific. And another part of experimentation that they don't really teach you in the science classes is that experiments must be replicated in order to be accepted by the scientific community.
Mm-hmm. Or at least begin or open up that dialogue in the first place.
Precisely. And that was one of the other major issues. As you can tell, Andrew Wakefield's experiment had a lot of major issues, which is why it was eventually revoked from the public. But worldwide, researchers tried to replicate his studies, but they never could. So just that study just makes me so angry on so many levels. Because so many people followed him. Celebrities followed him. Because they did have personal bias towards that study. Because it did seem that this MMR vaccine caused their child to have autism. So that's why they felt so strongly for this study. It's crazy what human biases and emotions can do.
Yeah, and I don't blame most people, because this year I'm really lucky. I'm taking stats, so it's been nice to have a class where we're taught the context of numbers and how to make sense of numbers and what they actually mean within the experiment, because that honestly makes or breaks what you take away from it and how you actually designed the experiment in the first place. And I don't, again, think that's taught a lot, so it's hard for people to know what to make sense of the numbers. And even for me, too, obviously. Like, when I can't make sense of something, I don't know what to do. And sometimes I end up going on Reddit. I've been finding myself searching up, like, climate change Reddit and just trying to see what different people have to say. And I don't know if that's the best way to go about it, but it's tough. I mean, reading research papers isn't a blast, because you see their methodology and it's just long and lengthy. And then the problem with articles, like we've mentioned, is they're super extreme. And if you don't read all of it, you can miss some of the concessions or some of the more boring parts that don't come to a conclusive result. And that's also the one thing I want to bring up. We're kind of going all over the place with science, but it really is this large and complex field. And within the field, there are obviously disagreements, which also makes people cynical of science.
Yes.
Like with COVID, I think one of the largest arguments of why we shouldn't trust the CDC or any organization or things like that was because the CDC, or at least the people representing the CDC, changed their minds on a lot of things. But that's kind of how the process works whenever you're in a time crunch.
They're trying their best to give the public the most relevant and recent information that they've gathered.
Yeah.
And obviously, they're getting more information as time goes on, so their conclusions are going to change. But people take that as being indecisive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not the case.
Or science doesn't know.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think one of the more famous kind of disagreements within the scientific community, I mean, I think just within, like in general, is climate change. It's one thing I found out, and Jenny knows, because I ran up to school and asked, I talked to her about it, but One of the things I was actually really surprised about is we're thrown the statistic, like 97% of scientists believe that there is human-caused climate change. But what we don't talk about a lot and what isn't seen a lot is the extent of which humans cause climate change. And that's still being widely contested. I was talking to someone who didn't strongly believe in climate change, and I'm sure they had some bias because of that, but how they explained it to me was the simulations you use to predict the climate and to see and evaluate the effects of what we have to do with the changing temperature. A lot of the times they're not as accurate as it could be, and it brings us back to limitations again. I mean, so what do you make of it then? Because everything is going to have a limitation. Yeah. It's like what we wrote in the newsletter. If you want the realest, I guess, quote unquote, simulation, you're sacrificing the practicality of it, and it takes just longer to run and longer to produce. Exactly. So where is that balancing point? And yeah, how do you shape your opinions around that?
Precisely. And I think like so many simulations people use without including that context and without recognizing those limitations, because there are two sides to simulations, right? There's the one side where you can look at a simulation and recognize that, okay, this does have limitations, but inevitably, the simulation does have merit. So that's kind of my stance on those climate change simulations, right? I understand that there are limitations, and it might be slightly skewed, but overall, the conclusion does make sense to me, and I do believe it. But then there are simulations where the limitations massively overweigh, like, what it can represent. For example, I was showing Victoria before we started this, simulations they use in classrooms to simulate experiences or to help create empathy within students.
In simulations, that's a very broad term, but generally it just means you're trying to recreate a portion of reality. Mm-hmm. And the end result of a simulation can range from a graph, like the one we had in our newsletter, but it can also take form of, like what Jenny's saying, an experience, mm-hmm. and trying to recreate, like, you being in that place.
Exactly. So, you know, the purpose of these simulations that they had the students go through was to create empathy. But they were trying to simulate terrible, unsimulatable experiences, like the Holocaust, Japanese internment camps, slavery, oppression, just these very big events that killed so many people, and that I think that you just can't simulate within a 40-minute period, and by having kids lay down. Like, so there's that balance of seeing a simulation and being like, okay, these limitations do not outweigh the conclusion drawn for the simulation. And then there are simulations where it's like the limitations are so above and beyond what it can simulate or what it's trying to simulate that the results of that simulation just are so invalid.
Like, it raises the question of intent versus end goal. Bringing back to what you said about climate change, I think regardless of what you think and regardless of what models say and the extent of which climate change is happening, the way I view it is I don't think it matters, because, I mean, either way, we need to go to green energy. I mean, we need to start being more mindful of plastic. I mean, recycling, that's, like, very trite, but, I mean, it's important. And,
like, sustainability.
Yeah, not going towards, like, mass consumerism and just being careful between what you buy. Like, for me, like, those simulations, regardless of, again, the extent of which the results show that we're causing climate change, it to me sends the message that, I mean, I need to start caring about the environment, because, like, period, it's just getting worse. And I mean, like, the climate is changing. And I think for the examples of, like, the teachers simulating events,
like, that's just, you can't simulate those experiences.
And the worst part is I'm pretty sure they're well-intentioned, so it makes it
They are so well-intentioned.
Yeah.
But you just can't do that. Like, so obviously we ourselves have never been a part of those simulations in which teachers tried to simulate those events. But we were talking about this before, where a history teacher told us the importance of you know, primary sources versus secondary sources. And primary sources are really the sources that you want to look for because, you know, they were there. And so the first time I was exposed to the experiences of those in the Holocaust was through reading a primary source book. For those of you who haven't read the book Night by, I think it was Eli Weisel. I think that's how you say his name. He was one of the first Holocaust survivors to publish a book on his experiences in the Holocaust. And it really changed a lot of things and how the public saw the Holocaust. And, you know, that book made me cry. And it made me realize, even through his book and through his retelling of the experiences, that I could never understand what he was going through or what he went through. And I think that brings... That brings up a speech that we saw in Speech and Debate. The person who won our event original oratory, Halima, comparing apples to oranges, her main purpose was like, you can't understand what another person went or is going through without actually experiencing that yourself.
Yeah. I mean, those simulations, intent doesn't matter, end up minimizing the actual experience. And the history teacher basically told us that whenever you're trying to create empathy, since you want to empower next generation, you know, of leaders who care and are able to feel emotions, you don't want to manufacture experiences in any way. And instead, reading things like Night, I remember the first book I read about the Holocaust was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And it was very impactful because it was from his own words. And to some extent, people might argue, I mean, it's less impactful because you're reading, but I was watching this one video. It's by John Fish, who's this YouTuber. And he was talking about the importance of reading.
So the next phenomena come from a study which came out of Emory University, which looked at the lingering effects of reading on the brain. So what they did, the way the study was formatted, was over a few weeks. They took about 21 undergraduate students from the university and they had them read about a 30-page section of a novel in the evening. And then the next morning, they put them into an fMRI and they compared what was happening in their brain to what was happening in their brain during a resting state before they had begun reading the novel. Now, the first thing that they found, which I think is very interesting, is they found heightened activity in the central sulcus of the brain. The way that I understand it is the sensory neurons in your brain, which would be firing if you are, for example, running, also fire when you are thinking about running or reading about running. So you're quite literally kind of putting yourself in someone else's shoes when you're reading about them. It's this very empathetic connection. So what I think is interesting about this research, which kind of backs up with anecdotes, right, is that reading a novel is not just like a coldly analytical thing. And this is what I really hate about how reading is sometimes taught in schools, which is this very heavy analysis, you know, what does the author mean by the curtains are blue? What emotion is that trying to signify, right? It doesn't let you get into the story. It doesn't let you empathize with the characters. But when you're reading in this way that you're actually getting into the story like this and you're putting yourself in the character's shoes, your brain is quite literally imagining you in those shoes. Those same sensory neurons are firing. And I don't know, I just think that's really interesting. Like, it's not the analysis of things, it's that your brain is actually experiencing it to some extent.
No, yeah, so that was a video by YouTuber John Fish. Their YouTube video is called How Reading Changes Your Brain. And watching that video made me realize, like, reading is a simulation.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting way to put it. Reading is, to some capacity, a simulation. Since you are going through the feelings, journey, and thoughts of the characters, or in some cases, real people and their stories and their actual lives. And I think that's kind of the beautiful thing about all of this. Even though there are so many complexities and unresolved bits that make us, you know, kind of confused, or what should we even think of this? At the end of the day, there are so many ways to supplement a decision that you make. And I think the cool thing is you can combine, not simulations in the classroom, not in that case, but you can combine like simulations on climate change and then hearing first count perspectives of, you know, water levels, sea levels increasing and people who were actually affected and kind of put yourself in that simulation through different ways and understand that topic through different lenses to kind of further make a decision and actually come to some sort of conclusion with it. It's a really cool study. It's making me think a lot about history, I mean, and how we teach it too, which doesn't really relate to simulations, but it's like for so much of our life, we're trying to understand the past. We're trying to judge different events based on our moral code now. And we'll never know what people thought back then, even though there are obviously primary sources where people are recounting their experiences, but it's like what is it even like? Like what?
I completely get that. I feel like history is the study of past experiences and understanding like what people went through. It's not just dates and memorization. And like, I mean, obviously it is understanding history, but it's more of understanding how people interpreted different events.
Yeah.
And how people experienced them.
And that's, I think, kind of the dichotomy of simulations. One is like, we're trying to simulate the past where something already happened. So whenever you try to simulate it, you end up minimizing it. You end up oversimplifying things because you weren't there. So, I mean,
like
how would you know what factors came into play or what specific details that you missed because, again, you weren't there.
Or, you know, simulations that are trying to simulate the future.
Yeah. On the flip side, it's simulating the future. And that there's more gray area because nobody knows what the future's going to look like.
And if you do, hit me up. I want to know.
Oh, for real. Before 10 days, please. No, I think it's this dichotomy where what you're simulating just affects how you want to interpret it. Like anything, context matters. So I'm moving towards like simulations of the future. What do we make out of it? Because there are simulations of jobs. I mean, that's how economists predict how much automation is going to impact us. I mean, also simulations of our life expectancy. I mean, healthcare. What are our lives going to look like? And what do we make of that?
Yeah. How do we look at those and think about our future with accuracy, but also understand, you know, the limitations of those simulations and how much do we believe in those simulations and how much do we change the world now because of those simulations? Just so many different questions with something that seems to be the only concrete thing about our world right now.
Yeah. And again, we know simulations wasn't too appealing of a word. I know when I saw it, I was like, yeah, pass. But there's a lot more intricacy like within it. And also what I found in STEM is STEM seems very apolitical, but so much of the research that's done gets translated into policy, which ties into politics. I mean,
and boom.
I mean, it affects everyone. Yeah. So it's also kind of this larger concept we wanted to cover today, that STEM isn't just STEM. I mean, there's so much more to it that affects everyone. And I think there's something within that area that you care about that has some sort of connection with STEM that can broaden your view and broaden your horizons and make you think a little bit more about kind of how the problem pans out.
It's just so relevant. People think of STEM and I think with like science, technology.
Mark Zuckerberg. Harvard dropout. like what?
They're just like, I don't want. Well, I mean, you know, people are obviously like, they're either like super STEM-y, like, oh my God, I love STEM. Or they're like, no, I'm an arts person. I'm so humanities based. but really, all of the different fields are just for everybody, I feel, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think also within STEM, I was reading a lot about this actually because I was curious because my own personal reflections of the field were super like, I don't really like it because everyone seems super smart. Not sure if I'm up to par with that. And there is the stereotype in STEM, the loner genius stereotype. Yeah. And there's been a lot of research done on that. And it's really interesting because I think, I mean, how you view STEM ultimately affects how you engage with it. Like, what do you take away from news articles that talk about climate change reports or job reports or forecasting for XYZ or, you know, this new drug was found, this new vaccine was found for COVID. How do you engage with that? And it all starts from what we're taught in school and how we perceived it.
Because those who like feel as if they aren't STEM people are automatically turned off and believe that, you know, I can't read this article because I won't understand it. Because then, you know, they see like math or whatever, and then they think of like integrals.
That is not the case. I think that's also one thing that needs to be addressed. I mean, how we teach STEM in schools.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, make sure to sign up for our newsletter.
Mm-hmm. If you're not sure where to get started, I think this is a good place because it gives you the breakdown of where do you start when you want to create a simulation and what's the end point. Mm-hmm. It's simple, but it teaches you the basics and it kind of gets you set for whenever you're reading a news article or watching a video or talking with parents or anybody about it.
Exactly.
And thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, thank you for listening. Again, sign up for our newsletter. Make sure to follow us on Instagram, which is @StuffWeDon'tLearnInSchool. And our ending quote for this podcast is by author Paulo Coelho, who's the author of The Alchemist. And in his book called Veronica Decides to Die, it's a very happy-go-lucky book, if you couldn't tell already. That was sarcasm, by the way. He writes, "People never learn anything by being told. They have to find out for themselves."